Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. We've just gone through the excitement of the release of Charles Frazier's new book, 13 Moons, where there is a lot of attention to the Cherokee people, the tragic story of their removal from North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia. And if you ask after reading that book, if you ask who is primarily responsible for all that, it'll be Andrew Jackson. And Andrew Jackson suffered a lot of criticism for his Indian policy, his expansionist policy. Leading us to ask again, was Jackson a hero or was he some sort of villain? And we have the privilege of asking the author, I think, should we call H.W. Brands, can we call you Bill Brands?
Or is that call me Bill Brands. Just is so that okay? Long as readers know when they go looking for the book, it's H.W. Brands on the cover.
Has written really the first one-volume biography of Jackson in a long time, and there's renewed interest in Jackson. So we've asked our resident and the world's leading expert on presidential leadership, Bill Lechtenberg, to join us in a conversation about Andrew Jackson. Thanks to both of y'all for coming.
Thanks to be
here. Glad to be here.
Bill Brands, if you go to the Capitol building in Raleigh in North Carolina, you'll see a statue with our three North Carolina presidents, Andrew Jackson, James K. Polk, and Andrew Johnson. We can certainly claim that Andrew Jackson was influenced by his time in North Carolina, but was he born here?
Well, North Carolina still disputes his nativity with South Carolina. Jackson himself claimed that he was born in South Carolina. The confusion arose from the fact that his father died a few weeks before he was born, and his mother was traveling from one relative's home to another relative's home. And it's unclear exactly whether she made it all the way to the South Carolina home before Andrew Jackson was born. This is in the middle of March of 1867.
And so there's of 17.
1767. Yeah, 1767. And so there's enough confusion that North Carolina can claim him, South Carolina can claim him. But Jackson himself always said that he was born in South Carolina.
Well, that's very tactful for being in North Carolina, but your book's pretty definite that he was born in South Carolina.
Right.
And I guess we'll have to concede that that's the that most historians agree with you, but we're not giving up yet.
Right.
D.G., you ought to try to sell an ad to the North Carolina Chamber of Commerce in this coming week.
All right. But there's no doubt that Jackson grew up in and around North Carolina and among those people, and which you describe so wonderfully in your book. What things happened in North Carolina that framed him and prepared him for his future?
Well, the first thing was the American Revolution. And the American Revolution in the Carolina backcountry witnessed probably the most bitter fighting of anywhere in the country. It was not so much Americans against British. It was Americans against Americans. And Jackson participated in this. He must have been one of the youngest soldiers in the American Revolutionary Army. At the age of 13, he was a courier. This was in 1780. And so Jackson participated in the Revolutionary War. He lost two brothers in the Revolutionary War. He lost his mother. So he was orphaned by the age of 14. And when the war ended, here he was in the backcountry of the Carolinas trying to figure out what to do with himself. So naturally decided to become a lawyer.
And how did he go in those days? Well, didn't apply to University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill Law School. He did it a different way.
That was far too elaborate and formal. No. In fact, people in those days, if they wanted to become lawyers, they typically read law in the office of someone who had law books. And frankly, a lot of lawyers didn't have law books. And so not every lawyer could act as essentially the model and the mentor for aspiring lawyers. And so Jackson had to find a lawyer who did have a law library. The law library probably consisted of, I don't know, a couple of dozen books. But then after a relatively short space of time, he presented himself to the Board of Examiners, who looked him over and said, okay, looks like he'll pass muster, and made him a lawyer.
Wow. Well, what took him away from North Carolina?
Well, in fact, he didn't initially leave North Carolina. He went to Tennessee at a time when Tennessee was actually part of – it was the Western District of North Carolina. And the thing that took him west was the same thing that took any number of people west in the course of American history – greater opportunity. The eastern part of the state wasn't exactly filled up, but if you didn't have any family connections worth – noting, if you didn't have any money, if you didn't have any education, naturally you looked to the West because the West was building population, the West was building institutions. And Jackson believed that he had greater opportunity in Tennessee, the western part of North Carolina, than he would in the East. So off he went.
Wow. Well, we want to talk about, and particularly with Dr. Lechtenberg, about some of the things that prepared Andrew Jackson for presidential leadership. But one of the most interesting things that has come up for me in this book is that in a talk that you gave that's available on the internet explaining your book, you said, if only I'd written a preface to the book that explained what I was doing, like Dr. Lechtenberg suggested that I do, I wouldn't have to be responding to some of the critics who had the wrong idea about what you were trying to accomplish in the book. And I can't put myself in the shoes of the critics, but I think some of the discussion about your book involves whether or not you're just so admiring and so friendly, and that what you're doing is just trying to raise Andrew Jackson to the level of John Adams, like David McCulloch did with Adams. And you had a wonderful description of why Jackson was so important, of the critical fundamental things that made him real important, and not a rationalization, but a discussion of some of the things that give us problems today. And I wonder if you, I mean, it's not fair to ask you to give that whole speech again.
Yeah, well, at the top of the show, you asked the question of whether Jackson was a hero or a villain or something in between. And I go out of my way not to say he was either one, because I think that that simply obscures our understanding of what Jackson accomplished. I happen to think that history is – a certain kind of history is over-afflicted with hero worship. And you label somebody a hero, and all of a sudden it puts them on a pedestal. It sets them apart from the rest of us. What I tried to do with Jackson was not to make him look good or bad, but just to make him look the way he was. I do think it's important for readers or listeners to know that Jackson certainly was considered a hero by his generation. In fact, when I was working on the book, I was trying to get some sense of how popular Jackson was, how important he seemed to his generation and the generation shortly afterwards. And so I came up with what I will admit is a really quick and dirty assessment of Jackson's popularity. This was, of course, in an age before public opinion polling, so you couldn't find out how many people approved of Jackson's handling of this or that. What I did was I went to an atlas of the United States, and I looked in the back, in the index, to see how many places are named for Andrew Jackson. Now, I can't swear that every Jacksonville is named for Andrew Jackson. There might be the occasional Stonewall Jackson who slips in. But for the most part, there he is. And I compared him with the other kind of obvious suspects. And turns out that there are more places
like
named—
like Jefferson or Adams or—
Well, in fact, the top three are Jackson comes in first. And the next two, very close to each other, are Washington and Franklin. And in fact, this understates Jackson's popularity among that generation because Washington and Franklin had a 50-year head start on him. So by the time people started naming things for Jackson, all sorts of places were already named. But the fact is that Jackson was often referred to simply as the hero. He was the great man of his times. And people who study American history know that of all the commonly labeled eras in American history, the Revolutionary era, the early national period, Reconstruction, the New Deal, there's only one that's named for an individual, the Jacksonian era. Jackson was so central to that era that you simply cannot understand it unless you come to terms with Andrew Jackson. There's another reason I wanted to look at Jackson, too, and that was that there have been so many biographies written of what you call the first generation of the founders, and I confess to having committed one myself. I wrote a biography of Benjamin Franklin. But we know all sorts of stuff about Franklin and Washington.
Very widely acclaimed, by the way.
Well, thank you. But there's been relatively little done on the next generation. And I closed my Franklin biography with a statement that Franklin made when he came out of the Constitutional Convention of 1787. And a woman from Philadelphia stopped him on the street. The Constitutional Convention had been held in secret session, so nobody knew exactly what they were doing in there. And this woman stops Franklin on the street and says, "Dr. Franklin, what have you given us? What have you accomplished in your 3 months behind the closed doors?" And he looked at her and he said, "A republic, madam, if you can keep it." And so I took that as Franklin's generation's challenge to the next generation, Jackson's generation, and I wanted to see how it turned out.
Well, let me ask Bill Lechtenberg, is it, have we neglected in the last 10 or 15, 20 years, have we put Jackson aside? You sometimes go back to Jackson to look to the founding of the Democratic Party and all of these things, but have we missed the boat with Jackson?
Well, he's gone up and down like a fever chart. When I was young, there was Marcus James's biography, and then there was the great amount of interest brought on by Arthur Schlesinger's book, and that caught people by surprise. I remember being a graduate student at Columbia in my 20s and going down to the bookstore area on 4th Avenue in Manhattan, and I overheard one elderly bookstore man saying to another, "Can you believe it? A bestseller on Jackson?" Because he didn't seem to be a headline grabber, but now Bill is in his wonderful book is proving this all over again.
Well, you reminded me when we began this conversation that this is about Bill Brand's book, but I have to say that when I read Bill Brand's book about Andrew Jackson, it took me back to your recent book about the three Southern presidents dealing with their homelands in the South, and their. Andrew Jackson, primarily on civil rights, but also on the whole what government was about and who was preeminent, that Andrew Jackson could have fit into that model because he was just battling with his home region in the Carolinas all the way through, standing up and fighting and losing friends.
Yes, indeed, when Harry Truman came to Raleigh in the 1948 campaign and was under fire because of his civil rights committee's report and his own message to Congress, he identified himself with Andrew Jackson as someone who put the interests of the nation above those of his own section.
Bill Lechtenberg and I are talking to Bill Brands, identified on his recent biography of Andrew Jackson as H.W. Brand, about Andrew Jackson, and we'll be right back after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Bill Lechtenberg and I are visiting with H.W. Brands, who is the author of Andrew Jackson, His Life and Times, a wonderful one-volume story of really an incredible figure. Bill, maybe we interrupted you just a little bit as you were explaining some of the reasons for Andrew Jackson's prominence. And you mentioned to us that he was that number one, he was a genuine hero. And would you tell us about, would you tell us about what made him a hero?
Sure. Well, in fact, one of the themes that I tried to draw out in the book, but if I had taken Bill Lechtenberg's advice, the advice that he gave me when I wrote my very first book, and I don't know if you remember the letter you wrote me, Bill, where you said, you told me to strengthen the presentation of my argument in the preface. Because you can't always count on reviewers reading the whole book. They'll read the preface, but they might not read the whole book. Well, I wandered away from that advice, and I didn't write a preface because I really wanted to get readers directly into the story. But if I had written a preface, I probably would have saved myself a certain grief. Because one of the themes that I try to draw out in the book, I don't lay it out at the very beginning, but I do draw it out in the book, is that for Jackson, the overriding challenge to his generation of political figures was to preserve this experiment in self-government. And there wasn't a day of Jackson's life, from his birth in 1767 to his death in 1845, that he didn't think that it was under threat from internal dissension, under threat from Indians in the West, under threat from foreign invasion. And the reason that Jackson was considered such a hero to his generation was that he preserved America from these various threats. These days, it's not something that most Americans are proud of to say that Andrew Jackson was the great Indian fighter of the early 19th century. But to Jackson's age and generation, that was absolutely essential. When I was trying to get in my own mind what it must have been like to be a Tennessean in the last decade of the 18th century, the first decade of the 19th century, and how they felt constantly embattled. And they were constantly fighting Indians over who's going to control the frontier and who was going to chart the future of this area. The best I could come up with was the current attitude of Israel with respect to its Arab neighbors. And one could argue, and many people do argue, the what you could call the cosmic moral merits of who, whether Israel ought to be there, for example. But the fact is, Israel is there. It's been there for generations, and it's not going away. And Israel considers itself under constant attack. The same thing might be said regarding settlers in the western, what was then the western part of the United States. Now, Jackson and the Tennesseans believed they had every bit as much right to be there as the Indians. The Indians had their own view on the subject, but the fact is that they were fighting over this territory, and each side felt perfectly entitled to the land. Jackson was the great Indian fighter of his age. He was also the person who had defeated the British at the Battle of New Orleans. Now, the Battle of New Orleans, it's hard to take seriously from this distance, in part because almost no one can remember what the War of 1812 was about. It was one of those wars that ended with the status quo antebellum as the basis for the peace treaty, which basically means, oh, let's just forget we ever fought it. And the Battle of New Orleans is kind of a footnote to that footnote because, as every clever fifth grader knows, it was fought after the peace treaty was signed. But, of course, Jackson and the British at New Orleans didn't know the peace treaty was signed. And the other thing is that the peace treaty wasn't ratified. And I think there's very good reason to believe that if the British had won at New Orleans, they would have reconsidered the treaty because the strategy of the British was to attack the Americans at New Orleans and to defeat the Americans there and to march up the Mississippi River. They would then join up with the second British army coming down the Mississippi from Canada with the explicit aim of splitting the United States in two.
Sort of the way the Confederacy was split in two during the Civil War.
Precisely. And another thing, and this just bears out that the Mississippi was absolutely central to everyone's strategic planning about the United States until the end of the 19th century, until railroads begin to displace water traffic as the main.
Let me interrupt you because this was startling to me. And Bill Lechtenberg, I hope you'll help me with this, but I was the fifth grader in reviewing the importance of the Battle of New Orleans. And I thought it was a little bit of a stretch to say it would not have been ratified. I don't know what the treaty making ratification process is in Britain, but whether or not the British would have really backed away from that. And even in your book, you talked about the war weariness of Wellington and the other British about not wanting to get involved in America after this war. So. You convinced me, but then I started saying, well, let's wait a minute. Would it really have happened? Would it really? It's a good point, but would it really have happened?
We don't know. But what I can tell you is that the perception, and this all started with the perceptions of Americans of Jackson as the hero, the perception was that Jackson had saved the Union because the news of the victory at New Orleans arrived in the eastern part of the United States, the populated district of the United States, just before the news of the peace treaty coming across the Atlantic. And so, first of all, everyone had expected Jackson to lose. The Americans had lost nearly every other important battle of the war, and Jackson was not considered any more talented than anyone else. He was facing a much larger army, and including Wellington's Invincibles. These are the troops that defeated Napoleon. And so everyone expected bad news from New Orleans. Everyone expected to hear that the British had defeated Jackson, were marching up the Mississippi River. Instead, they heard that Jackson had won. And then right after that comes news that the war is over. Now, the news that the war is over is coming from across the Atlantic. The news that Jackson had won is coming from the South. Mm. But nonetheless, the juxtaposition of the two makes Americans think that Jackson won the War of 1812.
So whatever the reality, the perception was. Right. I wonder, Bill Lechtenberg, are there comparables to this kind of hero in modern presidential history? Anything other than Andrew Jackson and George Washington?
Well, I suppose the best example would be Dwight Eisenhower, who was identified with the landings in D-Day and the victory in World War II. I recall after the war seeing Eisenhower go down Fifth Avenue in an open car, standing as he always did in the car, and being treated as a hero. If I might, I'd like to pick up Bill on what he was saying about the Indians, and I thought you articulated very well what the problem is, and I think there's a lot to your parallel of the Israelis feeling beleaguered. But isn't the situation somewhat different in with respect to the five civilized tribes? Here you have Indians who have been tilling the land since pre-Columbian times, who have their own constitution, have their own alphabet. They're not pushing on the white settlers in Georgia. It's the Georgians who are pushing them out.
There's no question about that. And frankly, there's no question that the Indians, especially the five civilized tribes, got a really raw deal from the United States. And this was true of, for example, every presidential administration from George Washington's through Ulysses Grant's. And Jackson, as you mentioned, Bill, is this lightning rod kind of character, in part because he was so forthright. He was utterly impolitic. He didn't know how to temper his policies to make them sound good. In fact, there were times when it seemed as though he was going out of his way to make them sound as harsh as could be. One of the reasons that Jackson is credited or blamed for being the person who drove all the Indians out of the East was, well, in the first place, it was his announced policy. But of course, the president doesn't make laws. He encouraged Congress to pass laws, and Congress did. The Indian Removal Act of 1830 was passed by Congress, of course, at Jackson's request, but nonetheless, it was Congress that passed the law. The thing that people remember about Jackson was his apparently egregious disregard for a decision rendered by the Supreme Court in a case of the Cherokees versus Georgia in 1832, where Jackson supposedly said in response to the decision by Chief Justice John Marshall that Justice Marshall has rendered his decision, now let him enforce it. And that sounds as though here's a chief executive who's utterly out of control. He's going to do whatever he wants, and he's not going to listen to the Supreme Court, and he is going to run roughshod over the other branches of government. Now, I take some effort in the book to tease out exactly what is involved in that statement. In the first place, it's one of these statements that Jackson reportedly said. He didn't write it down anywhere, so we don't know it was said in those words. It certainly does reflect his sentiments about it. But it is worth noting, and this actually doesn't reflect on the Indian policy side of it, but it does reflect on something that Bill Luchtenberg certainly could comment on, and that is that we live at a time now in 2006 when it is accepted by everybody that when the Supreme Court renders a decision, that decision binds the other branches of government, binds everybody in the United States. The Supreme Court has the last word. It's why nominations of the Supreme Court are such a big deal these days. In Jackson's day, that wasn't settled opinion at all. Jackson simply did not believe that the decisions of the Supreme Court bound the executive branch. And he, in fact, stated this explicitly in the message that accompanied his veto of the recharter of the Bank of the United States. The Supreme Court had declared in 1819, in an important McCulloch versus Maryland case, that the Bank of the United States was constitutional. Jackson disagreed, and he vetoed recharter of the Bank of the United States on grounds that it was unconstitutional.
And so, let me interrupt you. Yeah. I apologize for doing this. This is such an interesting point for me in the book. When that, and it didn't prove to me that Jackson wouldn't obey a Supreme Court directive to him when he said that his analysis, that one of the reasons for vetoing the rechartering of the bank was that he didn't view it was constitutional. Now, even a president today could say, even though in vetoing a piece of legislation that was clearly constitutional under a Supreme Court edict, could use as a part of his rationale that he was vetoing it because it didn't comply with his notion of the Constitution
right.
as a reason for.
He would have a very hard time getting away with saying that I'm vetoing it because it's unconstitutional.
But to saying in my framework, in my understanding of the Constitution, notwithstanding what the Supreme Court said, this is what the Constitution says. And that's one of the reasons I'm vetoing this.
Right.
I mean, the president can veto it for any reason.
No one would take that part of the argument seriously in this day and age. But in Jackson's day, it did. But the bigger question regarding Jackson's Indian policy was what it signified. And that, and to Jackson's way of thinking, the Cherokees would never be safe in Georgia because the people in Georgia, frankly, were very much like the people Jackson had grown up with in North Carolina and Tennessee. And they simply couldn't accept the Indians living as separate tribes among them. They were sufficiently racist, to use the term. They were sufficiently covetous of the land that the Indians occupied. And Jackson understood, and I think he's right in this regard. This is a hard thing for us to accept. I think he's right that if the Cherokees had insisted on remaining in Georgia, they would have been annihilated. In fact, Jackson pointed out that there were hundreds of tribes that had occupied every basically square foot of American territory from Maine to Georgia. And 95% of those tribes had disappeared by the 1830s because they had died of disease or they had been annihilated by their neighbors. To Jackson's way of thinking, living peacefully in Georgia was not an option. The Cherokees would simply disappear if they insisted on staying. Wow. Now, one could argue that Jackson had an obligation as president to protect them. But even that would have been politically impossible because Jackson, there was no army, there was no standing army that he could use to defend them. He couldn't call out the Georgia militia to protect them because the Georgia militia were exactly the people who were persecuting the Cherokee. And he couldn't get Congress to pass the money. There would have been a handful of votes in Congress to raise a federal army to protect Indians in Georgia.
We're talking with Bill.
Welcome back to
Who's
Talking.
Bill Luckenberg and Martin.
We'll be right back.
Bill Luckenberg and I are visiting with H.W. Brands, the author of Andrew Jackson, His Life and Times. We were talking about the Indian policy. And Bill Luckenberg, before we took a break, I think you had a comment or a question.
Well, I think Bill is right in saying that it's hard to imagine however critical we are, and with good reason, of Jackson and American policy generally in the 19th century in the treatment of Indians. It's hard to imagine another scenario where the Indians could have stayed in Georgia and have been safe and not have been annihilated. That having been said, isn't it also true, Bill, that Jackson, in his desire to lower the national debt, did not see to it that there were adequate funds for the safe transit of the Indians to the lands west of the Mississippi, and then bears a share of the blame for the Trail of Tears that eventuated.
He certainly does. There's no question about that. And I wouldn't want to paint Jackson as someone who was the Indians' best friend by any means. If I were a Cherokee today, I would hold a great deal of resentment against Jackson. I think one can make a kind of objective argument that if not for Jackson, the Cherokee wouldn't have survived as a people, and nonetheless feel that the Cherokee really got the short end of the stick out of all of this. Jackson was as determined. Once Jackson set his mind on achieving a policy outcome, he could be utterly ruthless in making it happen that way. And when he decided the Cherokee had to move, they had to move. And he wasn't going to make it any easier for them than absolutely necessary. You mentioned that the Jackson wanted to pay off the debt. This was probably Jackson's proudest achievement as president. He thought that the federal government ought to live within its means, and he thought that efficiency in government was absolutely essential, in part because this was the obligation the government had to all those ordinary people who were supporting the government. And it's probably fair to say that Jackson considered paying off the debt more important than the safe transit of the Cherokees from Georgia, Indian Territory.
In the preface that you didn't write in your talk that explained some of the things that you wanted to accomplish in your book, you mentioned there were really three things that probably tarnished Jackson's reputation. One was as a slaveholder. The other, and we've talked about this considerably, is Indian policy. And the other, his expansionist policy. And I wonder if you'd talk just briefly about both the slavery and the expansionist policy.
Sure. Jackson was a slaveholder. Jackson owned fewer slaves than George Washington, fewer slaves than Thomas Jefferson. But it's harder for, I think, the modern sensibility to appreciate Jackson in some ways than it is to appreciate Washington and Jefferson. Maybe we don't forgive Washington and Jefferson for their slaveholding, but at least they give a nod to the modern age in realizing that this was wrong. Washington freed his slaves after his death. Jefferson actually was so far in debt he couldn't have, even if he wanted to. But he tells us in his letters, in his writings, in his comments, that he knows that this is an evil institution. And he says he shudders for America's future because he knows that God is just and there's this horrible institution that it's engaged in. With Jackson, Jackson owned around 100 slaves, maybe 110 at the maximum. And he never gave any indication that he thought that slavery was a horrible thing. Jackson's attitude towards slavery was essentially that it was a necessary evil. But there were lots of things in the world that were necessary evils. Jackson never glorified war, despite the fact that war made his reputation. Jackson was a cotton planter in Tennessee. If you were a cotton planter in Tennessee, your labor force was made up of slaves. Could he have imagined it otherwise? Jackson, unlike Thomas Jefferson, who lived up on his hill at Monticello and imagined a different, better world, Jackson always felt he had his hands full with the world that he inherited. He didn't have time to imagine a better world. It was all he could do to deal with the world that he lived in. He did realize, however, that slavery was going to be, if the Union did break, it was going to break on slavery. In fact, after he managed to face down South Carolina in the nullification crisis of 1832-1833, he predicted that this urge towards secession wouldn't go away. But the next time it came back, it would be over slavery.
If you make the point, and I wish we could talk at length about it, that Jackson's great contribution was saving the Union, both at New Orleans from the British and their Indian allies, and mm-hmm. against South Carolina,
right.
Which tried to do the same sort of thing that it did as Jackson predicted
right.
with respect to protecting slavery on another economic issue. Why was Jackson so strong a Unionist when there were people in other parts of his region who did not feel that way at all?
Well, it was a little bit unusual, and it surprised a lot of people that Jackson took such a strong line against secession, because in most areas of politics, in matters of government, Jackson was a states' rights man. He constantly contended that government that was closest to the people was likely to be the most effective, to the most credible, to deliver the best government. But his respect for states' rights always stopped well short of anything that smacked of secession, because Jackson believed that the Union was necessary for the success, for the survival of self-government. Jackson always felt that self-government, whether you could call it republicanism of his youth, democracy of his maturity, was under threat. It was still, in the 1820s, an anomaly. There weren't other successful. There was no example of a country, a nation that had governed itself over a long period of time. And Jackson realized that the British remained unreconciled. Certainly they did until the end of the War of 1812. He recognized that the Spanish, the French, the Russians didn't like the emergence of this democracy on the western shore of the Atlantic. He recognized that there were many people who predicted that self-government would fall apart from internal dissension. And Jackson simply believed that democracy, self-government, could not survive unless the Union held together. So for him, the two were absolutely essentially entwined.
Bill Lichtenberg.
Yes, I was struck by what you were saying about Jackson, despite the strong Unionist stand, being a believer in states' rights, which is surely true. I'm now writing a history of the American presidency, and there are only three presidents to whom I devote an entire chapter. Jackson's one of them, and mm-hmm. I must say your book is an enormous help
well,
to
thank
me
you.
In writing it. And one of the peculiar things is that if you take a look at the legislation that's adopted under Jackson, you find very little there. The first important one, as you were saying, is the Indian Removal Act.
Mm-hmm.
And yet he greatly strengthened the presidency. though often in order to make the central government less strong, unlike a successor like Franklin Roosevelt, for
right.
example.
Yes. For Jackson, it was really an assertion of executive authority, in some cases against legislative power. And so Jackson vetoed a bill to build a national road, believing that a road was a good idea. Every Westerner knew that roads were good ideas, but he didn't think the federal government ought to be paying for it. When he vetoed the renewal of the Bank of the United States Charter, I mean, it was partly because he distrusted banks, but in particular because he thought that it was unconstitutional. He said explicitly that Congress can create a national bank as long as it does business within the federal district, the District of Columbia. But beyond that, it doesn't have the power to do it.
Well, we need to take a break. Gosh, I hate to do it. I'm talking to Bill Luckenberg, and I are talking to H.W. Brands, the author of Andrew Jackson, His Life and Times. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Bill Luckenberg and I have been quizzing H.W. Brands, Bill Brands, about his book on Andrew Jackson. And Bill Brands said he wanted to ask Bill Luckenberg a question.
Yeah. Well, when I wrote about Andrew Jackson, I made the claim that after Jackson, the presidency changes significantly because now the presidency is the office of the people. And a key to getting elected is to demonstrate that you have a common touch. Even if you don't have a common touch, you still have to pretend you do. How do you see, I mean, you're writing about the presidency. I mean, how do you see that playing out in the generations after Jackson?
Oh, I think that's absolutely right, Bill. And if you look at the generation immediately following Jackson, these are all people who are in Jackson's shadow. James K. Polk, as you know, is called Young Hickory. This is for both good and ill, in that the Democratic Party, the main vehicle, it becomes the party of slavery and of expansion, and both have their roots in Jackson as well. But Jackson, in his first address to Congress, comes out as no president ever had before on behalf of majority rule. He is the first president who exercises a veto to the extent that he did, but also for reasons other than deciding that a bill was unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. That just said that he didn't like it. By the time he left office, the president of the United States was the tribune of the people, something he'd never been before to the extent that he was under Jackson.
It always struck me that Jackson insisted on calling the president the chief magistrate. And I don't know how long this particular terminology persisted, but that was the way he viewed what he was doing.
You're one of the poignant pieces, many poignant pieces in Jackson's story. One of them is that unlike President Jefferson and John Adams, who were great bitter rivals but who came to an accommodation at the end of their lives, that Andrew Jackson, sort of in the Jeffersonian tradition, succeeded John Quincy Adams, and that their bitter rivalry just got worse and worse.
It did, and I think it reflected actually the bitterness of American politics during that era. Because by the time Jackson left office, slavery was the issue that quite clearly was separating the sections, and slavery was one that didn't allow the kind of compromise that John Adams might have made with Thomas Jefferson. The reason that John Quincy Adams returned to the Congress, the reason, frankly, I think the reason he lived so long, was he felt that it was his obligation to preserve the Republic against the expansion of slavery. Jackson felt it was his obligation to expand the region of democracy. With Jackson, that happened to include slavery, but it wasn't essential to it. But Jackson and Adams really perceived themselves as embodying diametrically opposed views of what the Union was all about. There really wasn't the kind of chance for compromise there. And another thing is that if Andrew Jackson ever became your enemy, he was your enemy for life. And that's the way it was. If he was your friend, he was your friend for life. Jackson was loyal to friends to a fault. There were people that he should have written off that he didn't. He got in some political trouble as president because he was too loyal to friends. But as loyal as he could be to friends, he could be a bitter enemy for life.
Well, I'm sorry that we can't talk about all of those aspects of his of those parts of his character in which he really showed that he would stand up for his friends and he would take on his enemies either in duels or with his old hickory cane if he right. needed to. A great book by H.W. Brand's Andrew Jackson, His Life and Times. Read it if you've got questions about Jackson and whether you whatever opinion you have of Jackson when you're through with the book, you will have read a good story. Thanks to Bill Lechtenberg, and thanks to you, Bill Brands. Thanks to all y'all for listening. We'll be back same time tomorrow.